Hi, I'm Solana Pine. I'm the director of video at the New York Times. For years, my team has made videos that bring you closer to big news moments. Videos by Times journalists that have the expertise to help you understand what's going on. Now, we're bringing those videos to you in the Watch tab in the New York Times app. It's a dedicated video feed where you know you can trust what you're seeing. All the videos there are free for anyone to watch. You don't have to be a subscriber. Download the New York Times app to start watching.
From the New York Times, this is The Interview. I'm David Marchese. Pretty much whenever I watch a buzzy new stand-up comedy special, at some point I end up having to scramble for the remote control to hit the mute button because one of my kids has wandered into the room. The material's just too blue for their precious little ears. When I was watching Nate Bargatze's latest special, though, my 10-year-old walked in, I grabbed the remote, and then I realized I didn't have to do anything. Because the next joke he told with my daughter in the room was about drinking chocolate milk. If stand-ups today often catch fire by being seen as transgressive and dangerous, saying the things others won't say about subjects others won't talk about in language others won't use, then Bargatze has captured the zeitgeist in a friendlier way. He's low-key and clean, and his comedy traffics in highly relatable stories about the foibles of family life, his confusion with modern living, and his own lack of smarts. It's an approach that apparently works. His was the highest-grossing comedy tour of 2024. He's also found a new audience through a couple of recent and widely praised turns hosting Saturday Night Live. And now he's branching out to a new area with his upcoming book, the self-deprecatingly titled Big Dumb Eyes, Stories from a Simpler Mind. That kind of aw shucks attitude is a trademark of his, but as I learned, it's actually masking some surprisingly bold ambition. Here's my interview with Nate Bargatze. It's interesting reading articles about you over the last couple of years since your career has really taken off and you hit a new level. And the writers of those articles always try and explain why you've gotten so big. But what's your hunch about why you have gotten to the place you've gotten to over the last couple of years? Like, why you?
Oh, well, I always wonder why you. You know, I mean, I think you're talking about relatable things. And you're talking about, I think, authenticity. Not that I'm going out for authenticity, but you're in a world now where entertainment is, I think, there is no authenticity. You know, it's like you have the Wickeds and you have these Avenger movies and you have all this stuff that's great, but there's not like a regular person like on a screen anymore. And where the movies used to kind of be like that, where you would see Planes, Trains, and Automobiles and Home Alone, and you would have someone be like, all right, that's a guy. That's a regular guy in this movie that you enjoy watching. You know, it's like easier to watch and it's just easier to take in, and you just want to be entertained and you don't always want to be thought provoked. And that's something that I've always tried to stay clear of, because I realize, like, you know, I'm trying to sell you something. I'm selling you entertainment. So I need you to be able to come and trust that you're going to get the entertainment that I am showing you that I'm selling you.
You said, I'm selling something, which is an interesting thing to hear, because obviously that's true. And obviously that's true for just about everyone in the entertainment business. But usually, in my experience, people aren't so explicit in saying that. Why do you think there is hesitation on the part of some entertainers to say, like, hey, I'm selling something?
I don't know, because I think there's got this weird, I mean, it's just, I think, kind of in life in general, it's got this self-importance. You know, I have a platform, so I need to say something on this platform. And I'm kind of anti-platform. I don't need to use this platform to tell you what to do. You know, if I go want to give you my opinion and like tell you how what I think and all this, I also think that's a lot about me, is what I think. And when I go on stage, I try to remind myself, this night's not about me. It has nothing to do with me. If it becomes about me, it's too much. I can't handle it. But if I can make it for other people, now I'm just kind of an employee and I'm working. And so I'm just making stuff for people. And so it's not about my self-importance or any of that stuff. It just doesn't matter. You don't need me to do that.
Help me understand the distinction you're making when you say, you know, I don't want it to be all about me, because your material, it is largely about you.
Well, it's about me and the fact that I'm talking about myself and I'm making fun of myself, but the material's written for you. I mean, I just got a message today about a lady that's like, she doesn't like flying. And I get like messages like this all the time. And so she's like, I listen to you and you've helped me fly, because it's like, just, I don't know, it's like takes her mind off of it or whatever. It's the way you watch a show that's comforting. So anytime I think I want to go do something else, it's like I think about the her and go, well, that's not fair to her. I'm not doing it to make myself look good or look better or do this kind of stuff. I'm doing it to make you laugh. I always say you can laugh with me or at me. So it doesn't matter. You relate to it or you think I'm an idiot. Either way, I'm here to entertain you.
When you were starting out, did you feel any sort of peer pressure from other comedians to perform differently or tell different kinds of jokes? Because, you know, you work clean. You know, your stuff isn't really political in nature at all. There's a lot of family jokes, which I could imagine if you're, you know, a 28-year-old guy working comedy clubs in New York City, there's maybe not a ton of your peers are doing that kind of material.
Yeah, I think it was, you know, I would do a lot of shows starting out. It'd be midnight. It'd be a show called Uncensored Comedy. And, you know, and I mean, these are some of my friends are like very dirty. Yeah, most of the comics I'm around were the complete opposite of everything that I did. I had to learn how to do what I was doing in those rooms, but I didn't want you to notice that I was clean. So I think that is something that helped me into the fact that if I can go up and make you laugh and make this crowd laugh, I'm 28 years old in New York City doing a show. It's 1 a.m. These people are drunk and then I'm doing it. How can I do this material that's not doing sexual jokes or whatever everybody else was kind of doing? And so you learn how to try to hide it. Because I think if you walked up and said, I'm clean, it's going to be like, well, this guy's not cool and this guy's not this and that. And but I think it, I look back at it now, I think it, you know, it was like I was reliable for late night sets because I was clean, Fallon liked me. And so it was like an easy one to go do and rely on because, you know, I'm not going to say, I'm not having to like change my act for television.
Your family is the source of a lot of your material?
Yes.
You know, and your wife in particular? And I did wonder, does she have to vet the jokes that you tell about her? Like, if you're coming up with a joke based on something she's done that annoys you, say, or that you found strange, do you then go to her and say, like, hey, I'm working on this joke. Are you okay with that?
Yeah, I'll tell her. Yes. I mean, there's a couple times I'll go try it first to make sure I even want to. Because if it's not going to work, then maybe there is no reason for me to bring it up to her.
So, I know, but then if it works, you're even in more of a bind.
But if it works, then I go and I can figure out how to say it. And I always try to make fun of myself too in it. When I first started, I would do jokes about my wife and I could tell that the audience, if they don't know you and if you don't show love, then they're not going to go with you. So if you show that aspect of it, then you can get away with quite a bit. You know, with my daughter, I'm very sensitive to try to, I haven't talked about her a ton outside when she was a baby because I didn't want her to, I want her to be her own person. I want her to be able to trust that she can come to me as her father, which is the most important thing, and say stuff to me and not think anything she says I'm going to go tell the whole world. So it's splitting that balance to be like, I you want to be very protective of that for my wife, for my family, for any of them to know that, you know, I'm not just using all of them to gather material.
Your dad was a comedian and a clown.
Yeah.
When you were growing up. Do you and he have any competitive feelings about comedy?
He did. So he was a clown at the beginning and then he did magic. He's a magician. And I mean, he'll tell me like jokes and stuff and say, well, you didn't say this and say that. So I can talk to him about comedy and all this. But yeah, competitive. I mean, he comes out on the road with me and he's done 100 and some shows with me in arenas, and it's, I would say competitive. I mean, it's like different. I mean, when he came up, he would, you know, they had 3 kids and he had a day job and he did all this stuff. He could have moved to Vegas and, when we were younger and he chose not to. And so we grew up in Nashville and I think grew up with a very normal, I mean, as normal as you can with your dad being a magician, but he's very proud and he cries when he brings me on stage.
You know, I ask just because, you know, it's not, I don't think it's uncommon for when fathers and sons go into the same or related lines of work for that to sometimes be emotionally complicated.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure there is like some commitment to us. I mean, there's some when you go travel, like I love traveling with my dad. And then there's times where, you know, you're like, I always joke to be like, It's every little boy's dream, travel with your dad when you're 45 years old. So, you know, got a tour bus with a CPAP machine. I go really living it up.
You know, your dad grew up, you know, in pretty different circumstances than you grew up in. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of had a hard childhood. And then your daughter is then growing up in different circumstances than you grew up in. You know, she's just a lot, I assume, a lot more affluent. Do you think about how your daughter understands, like, how or why her life and her childhood are so different than yours or her grandfather's?
I don't know if she gets the extent of that. I think we've done a pretty good job. We moved back to Nashville. We live in a cul-de-sac. We're not around a big crazy neighborhood where it's, you know, just everybody's famous or wealthy or whatever. But yeah, but she, I mean, she has stuff. The amount of stuff I wasn't allowed to have versus what she has is, it's not even remotely close. You know, I wanted Jordan shoes, and but we got some from Dollar General, and they just kind of look like Jordan shoes. I would get all this stuff, the Super Bowl team that lost, I'd be wearing all that stuff.
Right. A lot of Buffalo Bills gear.
Yeah. According to my family, the Bills won 4 in a row.
You have been doing this a long time, but it's probably in the last 6 or 7 years where you sort of changed actually how you look.
Yes.
You know, you got a different haircut. You grew the beard and mustache, started dressing a little cooler. Mm-hmm. I think maybe you lost some weight.
Yeah.
Did the impetus to do that come from you, or did a manager or agent say, like, hey, if you want to get to the next level, we might want to think about making some changes?
Yeah. Kid Show Business showed up and goes, hey, fatso, if you want to make it, you better get your life together. It's both. It's a mix of, and no one told me to do anything. I mean, as a comic, weirdly enough, you're you and you're talking about yourself. So you are going to be you, but I wanted to do it too. And I'm going through it right now. I mean, I do not have great eating habits. And when I grew up, we just ate because you had to eat. Food was never celebrated, or food was just something you had to do. And so I eat a lot of fast food and a lot of chain food, and I get in bad and on the road. And I do realize it can get in the way, though. I stopped drinking in like 2018 because I knew if I wanted to get where I wanted to get as a comic, this was going to be in the way. And so I've realized that with food, too. If I want to do this thing, I want to do stand-up at this high level, probably make some movies, all this kind of stuff. Even for myself, I realized, all right, well, I have to go put in the effort for me to be able to handle all this kind of touring and the mentality it takes to stay focused.
Which is interesting to hear you say that, because you don't think of the, you know, the image that pops into the mind when one thinks of a comedian is not like a super fit guy.
I always say, I'm looking forward to the day you can't see my nipples through my shirt. So that's it. That's all we're working towards. One day we're going to get there.
I know you're working on a new hour of material. Can you share a joke or a section of it that you're feeling good about?
The thing about nothing to do, that's one that I'm working on. You know, that there's nothing to do. So the joke I do is bowling's still around. Because that's how, if you and your wife and your family is like, let's go do something, you go out to eat, you go see a movie, and you get to bowling a lot quicker than you probably should be. You know, it's 2025, so we have AI. I feel like bowling is a caveman sport that should have faded out, but that's how little there is to do, that it's still hanging around.
You know, we're talking ahead of the publication of your book, Big Dumb Eyes. And, you know, you joke in the book about not being much of a reader.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the way you've put it is, you know, books, they just have too many words. And to help readers, you know, you threw in some blank pages in your own book.
Yes, for people to keep their head above water.
But now that you've written a book, are you feeling any differently about books?
I thought of it last night as I was watching something. Like on TV, I'm like, I think this is when you should be reading, like before bed. You know, I was like, I think that's when people do it. That's why there's reading lights and all that kind of stuff. So I was thinking about getting just a fun book, you know, like what's an easy one? So it's like, let's start with something super fun and then just get into a habit.
Do you have a sense of what that book would be?
I looked up like the most popular books. It was like Christina Agathy. Is that her name? She's like an author.
Agatha Christie.
Agatha Christie. So I was all backwards. I think I'm dyslexic, so that should count as I said it correctly in my head.
Wait, that wasn't just a bit, Christina Agathy?
No, I thought that's what it was.
I'm sorry.
I ride the line. You don't know what's a bit, what's not a bit. You know, that's what I'm very protected. No one can really tell what's going on. And then I can, you know, depending on who I'm talking to, I can decide if it was dumb or not.
And, you know, even just the title, Big Dumb Eyes, or you already made some self-deprecating allusions to your own level of intelligence. But, you know, I know that's sort of the persona, but stand-up, you know, almost by definition, at least from my perspective, really requires intelligence. You know, comedians can act stupid or tell stupid jokes, but comedy involves crafting the material. It involves observational insights and editing the material. You need to have some facility with words. Are there aspects of comedic intelligence that do transfer over to day-to-day life?
It's being awareness. Being aware of just your surroundings and what's going on. Because you're looking for material. You're looking for things that happens to make a joke about or tell a story about. So you're always very alert. I mean, it's exhausting because it just doesn't feel like it turns off. You know, you analyze every interaction you have. You know, like I like seeing when I see two people talk and I realize that neither one of them really know what they're saying to each other and they're kind of on a different page. That's very fun to watch.
Is there an example recently that comes to mind of just something out in the world that you observed and thought, oh, maybe there's material in here for me?
I mean, one of them was my dad and my buddy, Nick Novicki. Nick, his eyesight's bad, and he's just kind of won't be paying attention. And then my dad's older, and they won't. So I watched them one time have a conversation in a hot tub. And so Nick asked him he's like, how's everything going? And my aunt was not doing well at the time. So my dad's like, well, my wife's sister's not doing that well. Then Nick goes, well, that's, you know, it's good to hear. Because he doesn't hear him. So they won't just acknowledge that neither one of them know what's going on. So they're just having conversations. And then Nick got out, dried off, and threw his towel away in a trash can because he thought it was a towel bin. So something like that. You can tell no one's really invested in what each other's saying. That's like what I like to watch.
You're just on the subject of larger ambitions. Something that I've seen you say in other interviews was, I think you mentioned, I don't know if you were being totally serious, but wanting to build something to replace the old Opryland amusement park with Nateland.
Yes.
What's missing in the amusement park space that you think you could help fill?
Well, like, I mean, just talk about the state of Tennessee and Nashville alone. Nashville is a great city that's booming, and there's a lot to do. There's not a lot to do with your family there. So when you have kids and stuff, you can go to Broadway, you can go drink and the bachelor parties and all this and a Titans game. And there is great stuff to do, but there's not a lot of stuff that you can do with your family. What I like about when people come to my shows is that it's children to grandparents are at these shows. They're able to go do something as a family. I think a lot of entertainment now is not made for the whole family. Even television or movies can be separating in the fact that I'm watching Narcos and my wife watches Housewives, and there's not a show that we're necessarily watching together. And so I do think there's a void in that. So I'm just going to, I look at stuff to go do with my daughter. I loved when we lived in California, we would go to Disneyland all the time. And like, you know, you look at Disney, essentially I would like to be able to build something in that aspect where people can, it's a big one, but.
You're not lacking in ambition. That's
no, good. No, I don't care. I mean, well, the ambition's like, I don't know. I've done all this. I'm nobody, dude. Like, and it's like, I just want to make stuff that people have somewhere to go to with their whole family. And, you know, it's easy to watch and it's fun.
Maybe this is related, but in the acknowledgments of the book, right at the end of the acknowledgments, you're writing to your fans. You write that it might not always seem like it, but I do have a plan and I hope you keep rolling with me.
Yeah.
What's the plan?
The plan is, I mean, I'm kind of doing it. It's like the plan is to be, if you found me and you like what I'm doing and this is, I don't want to betray that trust. So the plan is just to trust me. You know, I don't plan on touring forever and doing stand-up forever. I mean, I want to make movies. I think you get a lot of times that people can think, like, if you get too big, are you going to change? I mean, look, in the South, I can tell you right now, you can be like, oh, you're Hollywood now, or you're this, or you're that, or you're going to... The audience is very much in my mind with everything that I will make, and I will make stuff hopefully for them and with them in mind. I'm not doing it, again, I try not to do it for me. It's not to get my point across. My point does not matter. It's for you. And so I want them to be able to keep coming and see that I'm trying to do something I think that's a little against the grain right now. And weirdly enough, something being broad is, you know, I like when I started comedy, some comics would be like, well, I'm not for everybody. And I would be like, well, why would you not want to be for everybody? I want to be for everybody.
After the break, Nate and I talk again, and he tells me about his desire to serve a sorely neglected comedy audience.
I have a lot of grandmothers come to my shows, and they love me. I do really good with grandmothers. And I always love that, because I don't think there's much being made that they could go to.
Certainly not stand-up comedy.
No, no, no.
I'm Susan Lee. I'm a researcher and fact checker with The Daily. What I do is make sure details in our episodes are accurate. I also spend a lot of time reviewing pretty much anything a guest on the show says. Let's say they're describing the color of someone's sweater. If I find out this person actually wore a blue sweater instead of a red one, I have to make sure that we address it. And I guess some might think that this kind of stuff is trivial, but for us, every single fact in an episode matters. We all make mistakes. We're all human. But my job is to be that extra layer. The Daily is part of the New York Times. We do everything we can to make sure we get the facts right. Subscribers make it possible for us to do that. If you want to subscribe to the New York Times, go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
Hi, Nate. How are you?
David, how are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Thanks for taking the time to talk with me again.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, I saw a thing Mark Maron wrote earlier this year on his website where he was writing about the importance of, for him, of doing political comedy. Mm-hmm. And the way he put it was that, like, challenging people in real time with provocative material is where the real feels happen. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious to know your response to something like that. Is it just that a guy like him and a guy like you are almost working in two separate fields?
Yeah, it's just different types of comedy. I went on the road for Mark Maron. I opened for Mark Maron. A lot that I do on stage is stuff I learned from him. Maron is very much himself on stage. And so I always try to mimic that to be, how close can I be to me off stage to on stage? I think there's a place for that. For Maron doing it, and you need that. You can have that. You can also have this. I always joke that I'm a comic's parents comic. I stand behind my stand-up. I work on it very, very hard. But yeah, you do feel sometimes a little like, because I'm clean, like, yeah, you can get looked at like, wow, of course he sells all these tickets. It's easy. Or it's like, he's not doing anything challenging. I mean, I don't know. I kind of disagree with that, because it's hard to, you know, mainstream is not something that's easy to attain, even with movies. You know what I mean? Sandler did. That's not easy. That's why there's not 40 Sandlers.
I remember you on The Tonight Show, 2016, and you did a couple jokes about how you like Donald Trump, but then the joke was basically like, because you're so stupid that you that you believe all the, like, insane promises that he made.
Yeah.
But then in the same routine, you had these jokes about, well, you wouldn't vote for him. In that instance, then the joke wound up being because you were essentially too stupid to figure out how to go vote.
Yeah.
But would you do material even on that level now?
I would now if I felt it. So that was the reason I wrote that joke, was because everybody was saying they didn't like Trump, every comedian. So all the jokes were saying I didn't like Trump. So then I thought, how can I make a joke that say I do like him and be able to do it on Tonight Show where I ride a line?
Yeah.
Where no one's going to get mad. I don't want the people voting for Trump to get mad. I don't want the people that are not voting for Trump to get mad. I wanted to say the opposite of what everybody else was saying. So if I have an idea and I can do that, I will do that. I do like that challenge.
Are there other topics like that that come to mind where you feel an instinct to go against the herd in that way?
Yeah, I did it with the peanut allergies. I had a joke on about airplanes, like, you know, when they say you can have peanuts, like, who are these adults addicted to these peanuts this bad? These kids are going to die. And so that was one that, you know, there's a lot of people that would make fun of the peanut allergy aspect. And so it's just going the opposite way and just defending the kids that have the peanut allergies. And I like riding that line, and just when you make it self-centered, it's much easier to ride the line.
All right, help me understand this aspect of you, because I was thinking about it and I can't quite wrap my head around it. So you're this seemingly humble, low-key guy who is happy living on a cul-de-sac and doesn't want to go Hollywood. But then you also alluded to ambitions to build Nateland into, and this is your comparison, like a Disney-level production,
yeah,
which is not a normal-sized goal, even for a famous comedian. So is there like another more aggressive side to you when it comes to business? Help me reconcile the two seemingly disparate sides of Nate Bargatze.
You know, it is. I'm very driven. And, you know, I didn't go to college, barely made out of high school. Like, it's like, you know, I don't understand most business stuff. So you kind of just, maybe it's naive. I'm like, well, why can't we do it that way? You know, when everybody's like, you can't. I'm like, well, why not?
I'm not buying the whole yokel shtick, buddy.
Yeah. I'm good. I'm the thinker, the talker, like the visionary, I guess. And then you're good at putting people around you that do know all that kind of stuff. Because I never had a real job, so I don't know any of that stuff.
What's the last idea you had where you then said to someone you work with, like, can we make that happen?
So on the arena tour, when I first started going, our screens, because you're in an arena, I wanted the screens to be bigger. I was like, they should be bigger because I want the experience for the audience to be as great as it can be. And I was told they can't be bigger. I was like, well, that doesn't make sense. And I'm fine with being told no, but I just want to know it went through the whole system. I want to be told exactly, like, the building's not big enough or whatever. And for this next tour, we do have bigger screens. Because I get a lot of people when I say I want to do a theme park, and I've had it with friends where I say I want to do this, and they're like, why? Why would you? You basically get told you can't do anything because it doesn't make sense for, I guess, how I've lived to think that I want to go do all this other stuff.
What would be in the Nateland theme park?
Just rides.
Rides.
You know, ideally, I would want it to be like a Universal Studios kind of thing where we can be shooting movies on one part and then you have the theme park on the other and kind of just build that. I just want to build a world where people can be discovered. I think that's a big driving point for me is, like, when I came up, I think a lot of people would not get out of the way for the next younger people. Like in comedy clubs, when you're coming up and you can't get spots at that club because the guys that have been there for 15 years are not moving or going somewhere else. And so I want to, like, have places for, you know, new artists to be able to, I don't know, come do something.
I don't want to be another one of those naysayers, but okay, Universal Studios / theme park. I think you need like $1 billion to do that.
Yeah, well, then look, we got some stuff we got to get through, you know. I was going to ask you how much money you have, if you could give it to me. We're asking for everyone doing a Venmo. You need a lot of stuff. I do agree. The one thing I've learned, though, is in a business, money's not the problem. People have a lot of money. There's a lot of money, and money gets used in a lot of different ways and stuff like that. So hopefully we can get there. This is not something that is going to be tomorrow, but I feel like driven to do it. So, you know, we're going to give it a go.
I want to go back to the book. In it, you mentioned that you were raised Baptist, your parents are Baptist, and you write very movingly about how your dad at one point found a deeper level of faith.
Yeah.
You call it his moment of testimony. Have you had a moment of testimony?
Yeah, I mean, I feel sometimes I'm having it now, you know? I mean, I think that's where the drive and all this stuff is coming from, to make sure that you can bring your child to my stand-up show, that I want you to come as a family and you go do stuff. And I think about those moments of, you know, I have with my daughter, all these little dumb moments of you going to the movies with your family, because it's fun to get on, watch your kid try to talk you into buying candy and popcorn and all these little silly kind of moments that you think back on. So I think I'm going through it now. I think it's constantly having to work on it, constantly just reminding myself to be out of it and make sure that this life is not about me. So yeah, I mean, it's just a constant going on.
So I think I follow what you're saying. The idea is that there's almost a deeper motivation or a spiritual impetus for trying to create these moments for families where families can be together. And that in some way is your attempt at doing service for God. Is that right?
Yeah, it's attempted service to, you know, it's a big belief to be, I am second to God, second to your family, second to, you know, I believe the audience, second to everybody. You kind of live to serve. So it's very much a calling in that aspect that I feel. But again, it's like, it's trying to ride that balance. And I don't want anybody that's not this or that or whatever everybody is, that doesn't matter. I just want to make something that all of them can be in the room together. And I feel it's driven on a bigger purpose for me, but, you know, it's like everybody has their own things.
I sense a little hesitation on your part in wanting to say there's a spiritual motivation behind it, but I think—
Well, you're nervous about it, about being labeled. You don't want to be this kind of thing, because stuff gets faith-based or stuff gets like that. Like, people write stuff off, or they take it, especially now, in very different ways.
Yeah, but, you know, it's like the moments when you're with your kids and your wife or your partner, and you're all doing something and just having a joyful time. I'm not a particularly religious person, but those are holy moments.
I mean, that's where really what it comes from is just, I remember our daughter's first movie was Moana. And so going to sit and watch it, we sat in the very back and, you know, it's like, the whole experience of that day is like, that's something that I remember. And that's, you know, that's a dumb day. In the grand scheme of things, you're not doing, no one's in school, no one's taking a test, it's not this crazy important days, but those are the ones that you tend to go back to and remember. And so, yeah, creating those moments. I always see older, I have a lot of grandmothers come to my shows, and they love me. I do really good with grandmothers. And I always love that, because I don't think there's much being made that they could go to.
Certainly not stand-up comedy.
No. That's the goal. I'm trying to be only grandmothers. Shows are at 8:30 a.m. That's the late show.
You know, earlier you had mentioned that you don't plan on touring forever or doing stand-up forever.
Yeah.
Do you actually know currently when you'll stop?
I do. I could see the next specials will be on Netflix. You know, I could see maybe one more special after that. And I don't want to overstay my welcome. I also want to get out of the way. If I preach it, and I was frustrated by it, I need to live by that. And so I do think there's a point I need to get out of the way. I need to step aside and let the next wave of comedians come up. And I don't want to be just hovering in the spotlight. And, you know, I got this tour and then maybe one more tour. And then just from there, just I got movies I want to do and then do that and then start running Nateland.
Wow, I feel like that's big news that Nate Bargatze knows he's going to stop in a couple of years.
Yeah. We're doing this interview in 10 years, and I'm like, you know what? I got back into it, all right? I'm only doing stand-up. I don't have a theme park. I have a carnival. I have a carnival that travels. That's all I can make it. It couldn't do a theme park. Still something. There's still some rides.
That's Nate Bargatze. His book, Big Dumb Eyes, will be published on May 6th. This conversation was produced by Seth Kelly. It was edited by Annabelle Bacon, mixing by Sonia Herrero. Original music by Dan Powell, Diane Wong, and Marian Lozano. Photography by Devin Yalkin. Our senior booker is Priya Matthew, and Wyatt Orm is our producer. Our executive producer is Allison Benedict. Special thanks to Max Carpenter, Roy Walsh, Renan Borelli, Jeffrey Miranda, Maddie Masiello, Jake Silverstein, Paula Schumann, and Sam Dolnick. If you like what you're hearing, follow or subscribe to The Interview wherever you get your podcasts. To read or listen to any of our conversations, you can always go to nytimes.com/theinterview. And you can email us anytime at theinterview@nytimes.com. Next week, guest host Gilbert Cruz, editor of the New York Times Book Review, interviews author Isabel Allende.
I think that my way of getting over things, of understanding, of exploring my own soul, my past, and also, most important, of remembering, is writing.
I'm David Marchese, and this is The Interview from The New York Times.